Side 3, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, continuing on page 72. But I saw other Negroes better off. They lived in blocks of run-down red brick houses. The old colonial railroaders had told me about Washington having a lot of middle-class Negroes with Howard University degrees who were working as laborers, janitors, porters, guards, taxi drivers, and the like. For the Negro in Washington, mail-carrying was a prestige job. After a few of the Washington runs, I snatched the chance when one day personnel said I could temporarily replace a sandwich man on the Yankee Clipper to New York. I was into my zoot suit before the first passenger got off. The cooks took me up to Harlem in a cab. White New York passed by like a movie set. Then abruptly, when we left Central Park at the upper end, at 110th Street, the people's complexion began to change. Busy 7th Avenue ran along in front of a place called Small's Paradise. The crew had told me before we left Boston that it was their favorite night spot in Harlem, and not to miss it. No Negro place of business had ever impressed me so much. Around the big, luxurious-looking circular bar were 30 or 40 Negroes, mostly men, drinking and talking. I was hit first, I think, by their conservative clothes and manners. Wherever I'd seen as many as 10 Boston Negroes, let alone Lansing Negroes, drinking, there had been a big noise. But with all these Harlemites drinking and talking, there was just a low murmur of sound. Customers came and went. The bartenders knew what most of them drank and automatically fixed it. A bottle was set on the bar before some. Every Negro I'd ever known had made a point of flashing whatever money he had. But these Harlem Negroes quietly laid a bill on the bar. They drank. They nonchalantly nodded to the bartender to pour a drink for some friend, while the bartender, smooth as any of the customers, kept making change from the money on the bar. Their manners seemed natural. They were not putting on any airs. I was awed. Within the first 5 minutes in Small's, I had left Boston and Roxbury forever. I didn't yet know that these weren't what you might call everyday or average Harlem Negroes. Later on, even later that night, I would find out that Harlem contained hundreds of thousands of my people who were just as loud and gaudy as Negroes anywhere else. But these were the cream of the older, more mature operators in Harlem. The days numbers business was done. The nights gambling and other forms of hustling hadn't yet begun. The usual nightlife crowd who worked on regular jobs all day were at home eating their dinners. The hustlers at this time were in the daily 6 o'clock congregation, their favorite bars all over Harlem largely to themselves. From Small's, I taxied over to the Apollo Theater. I remember so well that Jay McShann's band was playing because his vocalist was later my close friend, Walter Brown, the one who used to sing Hootie Hootie Blues. From there, on the other side of 125th Street, at 7th Avenue, I saw the big, tall, gray Teresa Hotel. It was the finest in New York City where Negroes could then stay, years before the downtown hotels would accept the black man. The Teresa is now best known as the place where Fidel Castro went during his UN visit and achieved a psychological coup over the U.S. State Department when it confined him to Manhattan, never dreaming that he'd stay uptown in Harlem and make such an impression among the Negroes. The Braddock Hotel was just up 126th Street near the Apollo's backstage entrance. I knew its bar was famous as a Negro celebrity hangout. I walked in and saw, along that jam-packed bar, such famous stars as Dizzy Gillespie, Billy Eckstein, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, and Dinah Washington. As Dinah Washington was leaving with some friends, I overheard someone say she was on her way to the Savoy Ballroom where Lionel Hampton was appearing that night. She was then Hamp's vocalist. The ballroom made the Roseland in Boston look small and shabby by comparison, and the Lindy Hopping there matched the size and elegance of the place. Hampton's hard-driving outfit kept a red-hot pace with his greats, such as Arnett Cobb, Illinois Jacquette, Dexter Gordon, Alvin Hayes, Joe Newman, and George Jenkins. I went a couple of rounds on the floor with girls from the sidelines. Probably a third of the sideline booths were filled with white people, mostly just watching the Negroes dance. But some of them danced together, and as in Boston, a few white women were with Negroes. The people kept shouting for Hamp's flying home, and finally he did it. I could believe the story I'd heard in Boston about this number, that once in the Apollo, Hamp's flying home had made some reefer-smoking Negro on the second balcony believe he could fly. So he tried, and jumped, and broke his leg, an event later immortalized in song when Earl Hines wrote a hit tune called Second Balcony Jump. I'd never seen such fever heat dancing. After a couple of slow numbers cooled the place off, they brought on Dinah Washington. When she did her Salty Papa Blues. Those people just about tore the Savoy roof off. Poor Dinah's funeral was held not long ago in Chicago. I read that over 20,000 people viewed her body, and I should have been there myself. Poor Dinah. We became great friends back in those days. But this night of my first visit was Kitchen Mechanics Night at the Savoy, the traditional Thursday night off for domestics. I'd say there were twice as many women as men in there, not only kitchen workers and maids, but also war wives and defense worker women, lonely and looking. Out in the street when I left the ballroom, I heard a prostitute cursing bitterly that the professionals couldn't do any business because of the amateurs. Up and down along and between Lenox and 7th and 8th Avenues, Harlem was like some technicolor bazaar. Hundreds of Negro soldiers and sailors, gawking and young like me, passed by. Harlem by now was officially off-limits to white servicemen. There'd already been some muggings and robberies, and several white servicemen had been found murdered. The police were also trying to discourage white civilians from coming uptown, but those who wanted to still did. Every man without a woman on his arm was being worked by the prostitutes. Baby, want to have some fun? The pimps would sidle up close, stage whispering. All kinds of women, Jack. Want a white woman? And the hustlers were merchandising. $100 ring, man. Diamond. $90 watch, too. Look at them. Take them both for 25. In another 2 years, I could have given them all lessons. But that night, I was mesmerized. This world was where I belonged. On that night, I'd started on my way to becoming a Harlemite. I was going to become one of the most depraved, parasitical hustlers among New York's 8 million people, 4 million of whom work, and the other 4 million of whom live off them. I couldn't quite believe all that I'd heard and seen that night as I lugged my shoulder-strap sandwich box and that heavy 5-gallon aluminum coffee pot up and down the aisles of the Yankee Clipper back to Boston. I wished that Ella and I had been on better terms so that I could try to describe to her how I felt. But I did talk to Shorty, urging him to at least go to see the Big Apple Music World. Sophia listened to me, too. She told me that I'd never be satisfied anywhere but New York. She was so right. In one night, New York, Harlem, had just about narcotized me. That sandwich man I replaced had little chance of getting his job back. I went bellowing up and down those train aisles. I sold sandwiches, coffee, candy, cake, and ice cream as fast as the railroad's commissary department could supply them. It didn't take me a week to learn that all you had to do was give white people a show, and they'd buy anything you offered them. It was like popping a shoeshine rag. The dining car waiters and Pullman porters knew it, too, and they faked their Uncle Tommy to get bigger tips. We were in that world of Negroes who are both servants and psychologists, aware that white people are so obsessed with their own importance that they will pay liberally, even dearly, for the impression of being catered to and entertained. Every layover night in Harlem, I ran and explored new places. I first got a room at the Harlem YMCA because it was less than a block from Small's Paradise. Then I got a cheaper room at Mrs. Fisher's rooming house, which was close to the YMCA. Most of the railroad men stayed at Mrs. Fisher's. I combed not only the bright light areas, but Harlem's residential areas from best to worst, from Sugar Hill up near the Polo Grounds, where many famous celebrities lived, down to the slum blocks of old rat-trap apartment houses, just crawling with everything you could mention that was illegal and immoral. Dirt, garbage cans overflowing or kicked over, drunks, dope addicts, beggars, sleazy bars, storefront churches with gospels being shouted inside, bargain stores, hock shops, undertaking parlors, greasy home-cooking restaurants, beauty shops smoky inside from Negro women's hair getting fried, barbershops advertising conch experts, Cadillacs, second-hand and new, conspicuous among the cars on the streets. All of it was Lansing's West Side or Roxbury's South End, magnified 1,000 times. Little basement dance halls with for rent signs on them. People offering you little cards advertising rent-raising parties. I went to one of these. 30 or 40 Negroes sweating, eating, drinking, dancing, and gambling in a jammed, beat-up apartment, the record player going full blast, the fried chicken or chitlins with potato salad and collard greens for $1 a plate, and cans of beer or shots of liquor for 50 cents. Negro and white canvases sidled up alongside you, talking fast as they tried to get you to buy a copy of the Daily Worker. This paper's trying to keep your rent controlled. Make that greedy landlord kill them rats in your apartment. This paper represents the only political party that ever ran a black man for the vice presidency of the United States. Just want you to read. Won't take but a little of your time. Who do you think fought the hardest to help free those Scottsboro boys? Things I overheard among Negroes when the salesmen were around let me know that the paper somehow was tied in with the Russians. But to my sterile mind in those early days, it didn't mean much. The radio broadcasts and the newspapers were then full of our ally, Russia. A strong, muscular people, peasants, with their backs to the wall, helping America to fight Hitler and Mussolini. But New York was heaven to me, and Harlem was seventh heaven. I hung around in Smalls and the Braddock Bar so much that the bartenders began to pour a shot of bourbon, my favorite brand of it, when they saw me walk in the door. And the steady customers in both places, the hustlers in Smalls and the entertainers in the Braddock, began to call me Red, a natural enough nickname in view of my bright red conch. I now had my conch done in Boston at the shop of Abbott and Fogey. It was the best conch shop on the East Coast, according to the musical greats who had recommended it to me. My friends now included musicians like Duke Ellington's great drummer, Sonny Greer, and that great personality with the violin, Ray Nance. He's the one who used to sing in that wild scat style. Blip, blip, de-blop, de-blam, blam. And people like Cootie Williams and Eddie Cleanhead Vinson, who'd kid me about his conch. He had nothing up there but skin. He was hitting the heights then with his song, Hey Pretty Mama, Chunk Me in Your Big Brass Bed. I also knew Cy Oliver. He was married to a red-complexioned girl, and they lived up on Sugar Hill. Cy did a lot of arranging for Tommy Dorsey in those days. His most famous tune, I believe, was Yes Indeed. The regular Yankee Clipper sandwich man, when he came back, was put on another train. He complained about seniority, but my sales record made them placate him some other way. The waiters and cooks had begun to call me Sandwich Red. By that time, they had a laughing bet going that I wasn't going to last, sales or not, because I had so rapidly become such an uncouth, wild young Negro. Profanity had become my language. I'd even curse customers, especially servicemen. I couldn't stand them. I remember that once when some passenger complaints had gotten me a warning, and I wanted to be careful, I was working down the aisle, and a big, beefy, red-faced cracker soldier got up in front of me, so drunk he was weaving, and announced loud enough that everybody in the car heard him, "I'm going to fight you, nigger." I remember the tension. I laughed and told him, "Sure, I'll fight, but you've got too many clothes on." He had on a big army overcoat. He took that off, and I kept laughing and said he still had on too many. I was able to keep that cracker stripping off clothes until he stood there drunk with nothing on from his pants up, and the whole car was laughing at him, and some other soldiers got him out of the way. I went on. I never would forget that. That I couldn't have whipped that white man as badly with a club as I had with my mind. Many of the New Haven line's cooks and waiters still in railroad service today will remember old Pappy Cousins. He was the Yankee Clipper steward, a white man, of course, from Maine. Negroes had been in dining car service as much as 30 and 40 years, but in those days there were no Negro stewards on the New Haven line. Anyway, Pappy Cousins loved whiskey, and he liked everybody, even me. A lot of passenger complaints about me Pappy had let slide. He'd ask some of the old Negroes working with me to try and calm me down. "Man, you can't tell him nothing," they'd exclaim. And they couldn't. At home in Roxbury, they would see me parading with Sophia, dressed in my wild zoot suits. Then I'd come to work loud and wild and half high on liquor or reefers, and I'd stay that way, jamming sandwiches at people until we got to New York. Off the train, I'd go through that Grand Central Station afternoon rush hour crowd, and many white people simply stopped in their tracks to watch me pass. The drape and the cut of a zoot suit showed to the best advantage if you were tall, and I was over 6 feet. My conch was fire red. I was really a clown, but my ignorance made me think I was sharp. My knob-toed, orange-colored kick-up shoes were nothing but floor shines, the ghetto's Cadillac of shoes in those days. Some shoe companies made these ridiculous styles for sale only in the black ghettos where ignorant Negroes like me would pay the big-name price for something that we associated with being rich. And then, between Small's Paradise, the Braddock Hotel, and other places, as much as my $20 or $25 pay would allow, I drank liquor, smoked marijuana, painted the Big Apple red with increasing numbers of friends, and finally, in Mrs. Fisher's rooming house, I got a few hours of sleep before the Yankee Clipper rolled again. It was inevitable that I was going to be fired sooner or later. What finally finished me was an angry letter from a passenger. The conductors added their bit, telling how many verbal complaints they'd had, and how many warnings I'd been given. But I didn't care, because in those wartime days, such jobs as I could aspire to were going begging. When the New Haven line paid me off, I decided it would be nice to make a trip to visit my brothers and sisters in Lansing. I'd accumulated some railroad free travel privileges. None of them back in Michigan could believe it was me. Only my oldest brother, Wilfred, wasn't there. He was away at Wilberforce University in Ohio studying a trade. But Philbert and Hilda were working in Lansing. Reginald, the one who had always looked up to me, had gotten big enough to fake his age, and he was planning soon to enter the Merchant Marine. Yvonne, Wesley, and Robert were in school. My conk and whole costume was so wild that I might have been taken as a man from Mars. I caused a minor automobile collision. One driver stopped to gape at me, and the driver behind bumped into him. My appearance staggered the older boys I had once envied. I'd stick out my hand, saying, "Skin me, Daddy-O." My story's about the Big Apple. My reefers keeping me sky high. Wherever I went, I was the life of the party. My man, give me some skin. The only thing that brought me down to earth was the visit to the state hospital in Kalamazoo. My mother sort of half-sensed who I was. And I looked up Shorty's mother. I knew he'd be touched by my doing that. She was an old lady, and she was glad to hear from Shorty through me. I told her that Shorty was doing fine and one day was going to be a great leader of his own band. She asked me to tell Shorty that she wished he'd write her and send her something. And I dropped over to Mason to see Mrs. Swirlin, the woman at the detention home who'd kept me those couple of years. Her mouth flew open when she came to the door. My sharkskin gray Cab Calloway zoot suit, the long, narrow, knob-toed shoes, and the 4-inch brimmed pearl gray hat over my conked fire-red hair. It was just about too much for Mrs. Swirlin. She just managed to pull herself together enough to invite me in. Between the way I looked and my style of talk, I made her so nervous and uncomfortable that we were both glad when I left. The night before I left, a dance was given in the Lincoln School Gymnasium. I've since learned that in a strange city, to find the Negroes without asking where, you just check in the phone book for a Lincoln School. It's always located in the segregated black ghetto. At least it was in those days. I left Lansing unable to dance. But now I went around the gymnasium floor, flinging little girls over my shoulders and hips, showing my most startling steps. Several times the little band nearly stopped, and nearly everybody left the floor, watching with their eyes like saucers. That night I even signed autographs, Harlem Red, and I left Lansing shocked and rocked. Back in New York, stone broke and without any means of support, I realized that the railroad was all that I actually knew anything about. So I went over to the Seaboard Line's hiring office. The railroads needed men so badly that all I had to do was tell them I'd worked on the New Haven, and 2 days later I was on the Silver Meteor to St. Petersburg and Miami. Renting pillows and keeping the coaches clean and the white passengers happy, I made about as much as I had with sandwiches. I soon ran afoul of the Florida Cracker, who was assistant conductor. Back in New York, they told me to find another job. But that afternoon when I walked into Small's Paradise, one of the bartenders, knowing how much I love New York, called me aside and said that if I were willing to quit the railroad, I might be able to replace a day waiter who was about to go into the army. The owner of the bar was Ed Small. He and his brother Charlie were inseparable, and I guess Harlem didn't have two more popular and respected people. They knew I was a railroad man, which for a waiter was the best kind of recommendation. Charlie Small was the one I actually talked with in their office. I was afraid he'd want to wait to ask some of his old-timer railroad friends for their opinion. Charlie wouldn't have gone for anybody he heard was wild, but he decided on the basis of his own impression, having seen me in his place so many times, sitting quietly, almost in awe, observing the hustling set. I told him when he asked that I'd never been in trouble with the police, and up to then, that was the truth. Charlie told me their rules for employees: no lateness, no laziness, no stealing, no kind of hustling off any customers, especially men in uniform. And I was hired. This was in 1942. I just turned 17. With Smalls practically in the center of everything, waiting tables there was seventh heaven seven times over. Charlie Small had no need to caution me against being late. I was so anxious to be there, I'd arrive an hour early. I relieved the morning waiter. As far as he was concerned, mine was the slowest, most no-tips time of day, and sometimes he'd stick around most of that hour teaching me things, for he didn't want to see me fired. Thanks to him, I learned very quickly dozens of little things that could really ingratiate a new waiter with the cooks and bartenders. Both of these, depending on how they liked the waiter, could make his job miserable or pleasant, and I meant to become indispensable. Inside of a week, I had succeeded with both, and the customers who had seen me among them around the bar, recognizing me now in the waiter's jacket, were pleased and surprised, and they couldn't have been more friendly, and I couldn't have been more solicitous. Another drink? Right away, sir. Would you like dinner? It's very good. Could I get your menu, sir? Well, maybe a sandwich? Not only the bartenders and cooks, who knew everything about everything, it seemed to me, but even the customers also began to school me, in little conversations by the bar when I wasn't busy. Sometimes a customer would talk to me as he ate. Sometimes I'd have long talks, absorbing everything, with the real old-timers, who had been around Harlem since Negroes first came there. That, in fact, was one of my biggest surprises, that Harlem hadn't always been a community of Negroes. It first had been a Dutch settlement, I learned. Then began the massive waves of poor and half-starved and ragged immigrants from Europe, arriving with everything they owned in the world in bags and sacks on their backs. The Germans came first. The Dutch edged away from them, and Harlem became all German. Then came the Irish, running from the potato famine. The Germans ran, looking down their noses at the Irish, who took over Harlem. Next, the Italians. Same thing. The Irish ran from them. The Italians had Harlem when the Jews came down the gangplanks, and then the Italians left. Today, all these same immigrants' descendants are running as hard as they can to escape the descendants of the Negroes who helped to unload the immigrant ships. I was staggered when old-timer Harlemites told me that while this immigrant musical chairs game had been going on, Negroes had been in New York City since 1683, before any of them came, and had been ghettoed all over the city. They had first been in the Wall Street area, then they were pushed into Greenwich Village. The next shove was up to the Pennsylvania Station area. And then, the last stop before Harlem, the black ghetto was concentrated around 52nd Street, which is how 52nd Street got the Swing Street name and reputation that lasted long after the Negroes were gone. Then, in 1910, a Negro real estate man somehow got two or three Negro families into one Jewish Harlem apartment house. The Jews flew from that house, then from that block, and more Negroes came in to fill their apartments. Then whole blocks of Jews ran, and still more Negroes came uptown, until in a short time, Harlem was like it still is today, virtually all black. Then, early in the 1920s, music and entertainment sprang up as an industry in Harlem, supported by downtown whites who poured uptown every night. It all started about the time a tough young New Orleans cornet man named Louis Satchmo Armstrong climbed off a train in New York wearing clodhopper policeman shoes and started playing with Fletcher Henderson. In 1925, Small's Paradise had opened with crowds all across 7th Avenue. In 1926, the Great Cotton Club, where Duke Ellington's band would play for 5 years. Also in 1926, the Savoy Ballroom opened, a whole block front on Lenox Avenue, with a 200-foot dance floor under spotlights before two bandstands and a disappearing rear stage. Harlem's famous image spread until it swarmed nightly with white people from all over the world. The tourist buses came there. The Cotton Club catered to whites only, and hundreds of other clubs ranging on down to cellar speakeasies catered to white people's money. Some of the best known were Connie's Inn, the Lenox Club, Barron's, the Nest Club, Jimmy's Chicken Shack, and Minton's. The Savoy, the Golden Gate, and the Renaissance ballrooms battled for the crowds. The Savoy introduced such attractions as Thursday kitchen mechanics nights, bathing beauty contests, and a new car given away each Saturday night. They had bands from all across the country in the ballrooms and the Apollo and Lafayette theaters. They had colorful band leaders like Fess Williams in his diamond-studded suit and top hat, and Cab Calloway in his white zoot suit to end all zoots, and his wide-brimmed white hat and string tie setting Harlem afire with Tiger Rag and Heidi Heidi Ho, and St. James Infirmary, and Minnie the Moocher. Blacktown crawled with white people, with pimps, prostitutes, bootleggers, with hustlers of all kinds, with colorful characters, and with police and prohibition agents. Negroes danced like they never have anywhere before or since. I guess I must have heard 25 of the old-timers in Smalls swear to me that they had been the first to dance in the Savoy, the Lindy Hop, which was born there in 1927, named for Lindbergh, who had just made his flight to Paris. Even the little cellar places with only piano space had fabulous keyboard artists such as James P. Johnson and Jelly Roll Morton, and singers such as Ethel Waters. And at 4 a.m., when all the legitimate clubs had to close, from all over town, the white and Negro musicians would come to some prearranged Harlem after-hours spot and have 30 and 40-piece jam sessions that would last into the next day. When it all ended with the stock market crash in 1929, Harlem had a world reputation as America's Casbah. Smalls had been a part of all that. There, I heard the old-timers reminisce about all those great times. Every day, I listened raptly to customers who felt like talking, and it all added to my education. My ears soaked it up like sponges when one of them, in a rare burst of confidence, or a little beyond his usual number of drinks, would tell me inside things about the particular form of hustling that he pursued as a way of life. I was thus schooled well by experts in such hustles as the numbers, pimping, con games of many kinds, peddling dope, and thievery of all sorts, including armed robbery. Chapter 6, Detroit Red. Every day, I would gamble all of my tips, as high as $15 and $20, on the numbers, and dream of what I would do when I hit. I saw people on their long, wild spending sprees after big hits. I don't mean just hustlers who always had some money. I mean ordinary working people, the kind that we otherwise almost never saw in a bar like Small's, who, with a good enough hit, had quit their jobs working somewhere downtown for the white man. Often they'd bought a Cadillac, and sometimes for 3 and 4 days they were setting up drinks and buying steaks for all their friends. I would have to pull 2 tables together into one, and they would be throwing me $2 and $3 tips each time I came with my tray. Hundreds of thousands of New York City Negroes, every day but Sunday, would play from a penny on up to large sums on 3-digit numbers. A hit meant duplicating the last 3 figures of the stock exchange's printed daily total of U.S. domestic and foreign sales. With the odds at 600 to 1, a penny hit won $6, a dollar won $600, and so on. On $15, the hit would mean $9,000. Famous hits like that had bought controlling interests in lots of Harlem's bars and restaurants, or even bought some of them outright. The chances of hitting were 1,000 to 1. Many players practiced what was called combinating. For example, 6 cents would put 1 penny on each of the 6 possible combinations of 3 digits. The number 840, combinated, would include 840, 804, 048, 084, 408, and 480. Practically everyone played every day in the poverty-ridden black ghetto of Harlem. Every day someone you knew was likely to hit, and of course it was neighborhood news. If big enough a hit, neighborhood excitement. Hits generally were small, a nickel, dime, or a quarter. Most people tried to play a dollar a day, but split it up among different numbers and combinated. Harlem's numbers industry hummed every morning and into the early afternoon, with the runners jotting down people's bets on slips of paper in apartment house hallways, bars, barbershops, stores, on the sidewalks. The cops looked on. No runner lasted long who didn't, out of his pocket, put in a free figure for his working area's foot cops. And it was generally known that the numbers bankers paid off at higher levels of the police department. The daily small army of runners each got 10% of the money they turned in, along with the bet slips to their controllers. And if you hit, you gave the runner a 10% tip. A controller might have as many as 50 runners working for him, and the controller got 5% of what he turned over to the banker, who paid off the hit, paid off the police, and got rich off the balance. Some people played one number all year. Many had lists of the daily hit numbers going back for years. They figured reappearance odds and used other systems. Others played their hunches, addresses, license numbers of passing cars, any numbers on letters, telegrams, laundry slips, numbers from anywhere. Dream books that cost a dollar would say what number nearly any dream suggested. Evangelists who on Sundays peddled Jesus and mystics would pray a lucky number for you, for a fee. Recently, the last 3 numbers of the post office's new zip code for a postal district of Harlem hit, and one banker almost went broke. Let this very book circulate widely in the black ghettos of the country, and, although I'm no longer a gambling person, I'd lay a small wager for your favorite charity that millions of dollars would be bet by my poor, foolish black brothers and sisters upon, say, whatever happens to be the number of this page, or whatever is the total of the whole book's pages. Every day in Small's Paradise Bar was fascinating to me. And from a Harlem point of view, I couldn't have been in a more educational situation. Some of the ablest of New York's black hustlers took a liking to me, and knowing that I still was green by their terms, soon began in a paternal way to straighten Red out. Their methods would be indirect. A dark businessman looking West Indian often would sit at one of my tables. One day when I brought his beer, he said, "Red, hold still a minute." He went over me with one of those yellow tape measures and jotted figures in his notebook. When I came to work the next afternoon, one of the bartenders handed me a package. In it was an expensive dark blue suit, conservatively cut. The gift was thoughtful and the message clear. The bartenders let me know that this customer was one of the top executives of the fabulous 40 Thieves gang. That was the gang of organized boosters who would deliver to order in one day, COD, any kind of garment you desired. You would pay about one-third of the store's price. I heard how they made mass hauls. A well-dressed member of the gang who wouldn't arouse suspicion by his manner would go into a selected store about closing time, hide somewhere, and get locked inside when the store closed. The police patrols would have been timed beforehand. After dark, he'd pack suits in bags, then turn off the burglar alarm, and use the telephone to call a waiting truck and crew. When the truck came, timed with the police patrols, it would be loaded and gone within a few minutes. I later got to know several members of the 40 Thieves. Plainclothes detectives soon were quietly identified to me by a nod, a wink. Knowing the law people in the area was elementary for the hustlers, and like them, in time I would learn to sense the presence of any police types. In late 1942, each of the military services had their civilian dress, eyes and ears, picking up anything of interest to them, such as hustles being used to avoid the draft, or who hadn't registered, or hustles that were being worked on servicemen. Longshoremen, or fences for them, would come into the bars selling guns, cameras, perfumes, watches, and the like, stolen from the shipping docks. These Negroes got what white longshoremen thievery left over. Merchant marine sailors often brought in foreign items, bargains, and the best marijuana cigarettes to be had were made of the gunja and kiska that merchant sailors smuggled in from Africa and Persia. In the daytime, whites were given a guarded treatment. Whites who came at night got a better reception. The several Harlem nightclubs they patronized were geared to entertain and jive the night white crowd to get their money. And with so many law agencies guarding the morals of servicemen, any of them that came in, and a lot did, were given what they asked for and were spoken to if they spoke. And that was all, unless someone knew them as natives of Harlem. What I was learning was the Hustling Society's first rule, that you never trusted anyone outside of your own close-mouthed circle, and that you selected with time and care before you made any intimates even among these. The bartenders would let me know which among the regular customers were mostly fronts, and which really had something going, which were really in the underworld with downtown police or political connections, which really handled some money, and which were making it from day to day, which were the real gamblers, and which had just hit a little luck, and which ones never to run afoul of in any way. The latter were extremely well known about Harlem, and they were feared and respected. It was known that if upset, they would break open your head and think nothing of it. These were old-timers, not to be confused with the various hot-headed, wild, young hustlers out trying to make a name for themselves for being crazy with a pistol trigger or a knife. The old heads that I'm talking about were such as Black Sammy, Bub Hewlin, King Padmore, and West Indian Archie. Most of these tough ones had worked as strong-arm men for Dutch Schultz back when he muscled into the Harlem numbers industry after white gangsters had awakened to the fortunes being made in what they had previously considered nigger pennies. And the numbers game was referred to by the white racketeers as nigger pool. Those tough Negroes' heyday had been before the big 1931 Seabury investigation that started Dutch Schultz on the way out, until his career ended with his 1934 assassination. I heard stories of how they had persuaded people with lead pipes, wet cement, baseball bats, brass knuckles, fists, feet, and blackjacks. Nearly every one of them had done some time and had come back on the scene. and since it worked as top runners for the biggest bankers, was specialized in large bettors. There seemed to be an understanding that these Negroes and the tough black cops never clashed. I guess both knew that someone would die. They had some bad black cops in Harlem, too. The four horsemen that worked Sugar Hill, I remember the worst one had freckles. There was a tough quartet. The biggest, blackest, worst cop of them all in Harlem was the West Indian Brisbane. Negroes crossed the street to avoid him when he walked his 125th Street and 7th Avenue beat. When I was in prison, someone brought me a story that Brisbane had been shot to death by a scared, nervous young kid who hadn't been up from the South long enough to realize how bad Brisbane was. The world's most unlikely pimp was Cadillac Drake. He was shiny, bald-headed, built like a football. He used to call his huge belly the Chippies' playground. Cadillac had a string of about a dozen of the stringiest, scrawniest black and white street prostitutes in Harlem. Afternoons, around the bar, the old-timers who knew Cadillac well enough would tease him about how women who looked like his made enough to feed themselves, let alone him. He'd roar with laughter right along with us. I can hear him now. Bad-looking women work harder. Just about the complete opposite of Cadillac was the young, smooth, independent acting pimp, Sammy the Pimp. He could, as I mentioned, pick out potential prostitutes by watching their expressions in dance halls. Sammy and I became, in time, each other's closest friend. Sammy, who was from Kentucky, was a cool, collected expert in his business, and his business was women. Like Cadillac, he too had both black and white women out making his living, but Sammy's women, who would come into Small sometimes, looking for him to give him money and have him buy them a drink, were about as beautiful as any prostitutes who operated anywhere, I'd imagine. One of his white women, known as Alabama Peach, a blonde, could put everybody in stitches with her drawl. Even the several Negro women numbers controllers around Small's really liked her. What made a lot of Negroes around the bar laugh the hardest was the way she would take three syllables to say, nigger. But what she usually was saying was, ah, just a law of a nigger, girls. Give her two drinks and she would tell her life story in a minute. How in whatever little Alabama town it was she came from, the first thing she remembered being conscious of was that she was supposed to hate niggers. And then she started hearing older girls in grade school whispering the hush-hush that niggers were such sexual giants and athletes, and she started growing up secretly wanting to try one. Finally, right in her own house with her family away, she threatened a Negro man who worked for her father that if he didn't take her, she would swear he tried rape. He had no choice, except that he quit working for them. And from then until she finished high school, she managed it several times with other Negroes, and she somehow came to New York and went straight to Harlem. Later on, Sammy told me how he had happened to spot her in the Savoy, not even dancing with anybody, just standing on the sidelines, watching, and he could tell. And once she really went for Negroes, the more the better, Sammy said, and wouldn't have a white man. I wonder whatever became of her. There was a big fat pimp we called Dollar Bill. He loved to flash his Kansas City roll, probably 50 $1 bills folded with a 20 on the inside and a $100 bill on the outside. We always wondered what Dollar Bill would do if someone ever stole his $100 cover. A man who in his prime could have stolen Dollar Bill's whole roll blindfolded was threadbare, comic old Few Clothes. Few Clothes had been one of the best pickpockets in Harlem, back when the white people swarmed up every night in the 1920s, but then during the Depression, he'd contracted a bad case of arthritis in his hands. His finger joints were knotted and gnarled so that it made people uncomfortable to look at them. Rain, sleet, or snow, every afternoon, about 6, Few Clothes would be at Small's, telling tall tales about the old days. And it was one of the day's rituals for one or another regular customer to ask the bartender to give him drinks, and me to feed him. My heart goes out to all of us who in those afternoons at Small's enacted our scene with Few Clothes. I wish you could have seen him, pleasantly, high with drinks, take his seat with dignity, no begging, not on anybody's welfare, and open his napkin and study the day's menu that I gave him and place his order. I'd tell the cooks it was Few Clothes, and he'd get the best in the house. I'd go back and serve it as though he were a millionaire. Many times since, I've thought about it and what it really meant. In one sense, we were huddled in there, bonded together and seeking security and warmth and comfort from each other. And we didn't know it. All of us, who might have probed space or cured cancer or built industries, were instead black victims of the white man's American social system. In another sense, the tragedy of the once master pickpocket made him, for those brother old-timer hustlers, a there-but-for-the-grace-of-God symbol. To wolves who still were able to catch some rabbits, it had meaning that an old wolf who had lost his fangs was still eating. Then there was the burglar, Jump Steady. In the ghettos the white man has built for us, he has forced us not to aspire to greater things, but to view everyday living as survival. And in that kind of a community, survival is what is respected. In any average white neighborhood bar, you couldn't imagine a known catman thief regularly exposing himself as one of the most popular people in there. But if Jump Steady missed a few days running in Smalls, we would begin inquiring for him. Jump Steady was called that because, it was said, when he worked in white residential areas downtown, he jumped from roof to roof and was so steady that he maneuvered along window ledges, leaning, balancing, edging with his toes. If he fell, he'd have been dead. He got into apartments through windows. It was said that he was so cool that he had stolen even with people in the next room. I later found out that Jump Steady always keyed himself up high on dope when he worked. He taught me some things that I was to employ in later years when hard times would force me to have my own burglary ring. I should stress that Smalls wasn't any nest of criminals. I dwell upon the hustlers because it was their world that fascinated me. Actually, for the nightlife crowd, Smalls was one of Harlem's two or three most decorous night spots. In fact, the New York City Police Department recommended Smalls to white people who would ask for a safe place in Harlem. The first room I got after I left the railroad, half of Harlem roomed, was in the 800 block of St. Nicholas Avenue. You could walk into one or another room in this house and get a hot fur coat, a good camera, fine perfume, a gun, anything from hot women to hot cars, even hot ice. I was one of the very few males in this rooming house. This was during the war, when you couldn't turn on the radio and not hear about Guadalcanal or North Africa. In several of the apartments, the women tenants were prostitutes. The minority were in some other racket or hustle, boosters, numbers runners, or dope peddlers. And I'd guess that everyone who lived in the house used dope of some kind. This shouldn't reflect too badly on that particular building, because almost everyone in Harlem needed some kind of hustle to survive and needed to stay high in some way to forget what they had to do to survive. It was in this house that I learned more about women than I ever did in any other single place. It was these working prostitutes who schooled me to things that every wife and every husband should know. Later on, it was chiefly the women who weren't prostitutes who taught me to be very distrustful of most women. There seemed to be a higher code of ethics and sisterliness among those prostitutes than among numerous ladies of the church, who have more men for kicks than the prostitutes have for pay. And I'm talking about both black and white. Many of the black ones in those wartime days were right in step with the white ones and having husbands fighting overseas while they were laying up with other men, even giving them their husbands' money. And many women just faked as mothers and wives while playing the field as hard as prostitutes with their husbands and children right there in New York. I got my first schooling about the cesspool morals of the white man from the best possible source, from his own women. And then as I got deeper into my own life of evil, I saw the white man's morals with my own eyes. I even made my living, helping to guide him to the sick things he wanted. I was young, working in the bar, not bothering with these women. Probably I touched their kid brother instincts, something like that. Some would drop into my room when they weren't busy, and we would smoke reefers and talk. It generally would be after their morning rush. But let me tell you about that rush. Seeing the hallways and stairs busy any hour of the night with white and black men coming and going was no more than one would expect when one lived in a building out of which prostitutes were working. But what astonished me was the full house crowd that rushed in between, say, 6 and 7:30 in the morning, then rushed away, and by about 9, I would be the only man in the house. It was husbands who had left home in time to stop by this St. Nicholas Avenue house before they went on to work. Of course, not the same ones every day, but always enough of them to make up the rush. And it included white men who had come in cabs all the way up from downtown. Domineering, complaining, demanding wives who had just about psychologically castrated their husbands were responsible for the early rush. These wives were so disagreeable and had made their men so tense that they were robbed of the satisfaction of being men. To escape this tension and the chance of being ridiculed by his own wife, each of these men had gotten up early and come to a prostitute. The prostitutes had to make it their business to be students of men. They said that after most men passed their virile 20s, they went to bed mainly to satisfy their egos. And because a lot of women don't understand it that way, they damage and wreck a man's ego. No matter how little virility a man has to offer, prostitutes make him feel for a time that he's the greatest man in the world. That's why these prostitutes had that morning rush of business. More wives could keep their husbands if they realized their greatest urge is to be men. Those women would tell me anything. Funny little stories about the bedroom differences they saw between white and black men. The perversities. I thought I'd heard the whole range of perversities until I later became a steerer taking white men to what they wanted. Everyone in the house laughed about the little Italian fellow whom they called the $10-a-minute man. He came without fail every noontime from his little basement restaurant up near the polo grounds. The joke was he never lasted more than 2 minutes. But he always left $20. Most men the prostitutes felt were too easy to push around. Every day these prostitutes heard their customers complaining that they never heard anything but griping from women who were being taken care of and given everything. The prostitutes said that most men needed to know what the pimps knew. A woman should occasionally be babied enough to show her the man had affection. But beyond that, she should be treated firmly. These tough women said that it worked with them. All women, by their nature, are fragile and weak. They are attracted to the male in whom they see strength. From time to time, Sophia would come over to see me from Boston. Even among Harlem Negroes, her looks gave me status. They were just like the Negroes everywhere else. That was why the white prostitutes made so much money. It didn't make any difference if you were in Lansing, Boston, or New York. What the white racist said, and still says, was right in those days. All you had to do was put a white girl anywhere close to the average black man and he would respond. The black woman also made the white man's eyes light up, but he was slick enough to hide it. Sophia would come in on a late afternoon train. She would come to Small's and I'd introduce her around until I got off from work. She was bothered about me living among the prostitutes until I introduced her to some of them, and they talked, and she thought they were great. They would tell her they were keeping me straight for her. We would go to the Braddock Hotel bar, where we would meet some of the musicians, who now would greet me like an old friend. "Hey, Red, who have we got here?" They would make a great deal over her. I couldn't even think about buying a drink. No Negroes in the world were more white woman crazy in those days than most of those musicians. People in show business, of course, were less inhibited by social and racial taboos. The white racist won't tell you that it also works in reverse. When it got late, Sophia and I would go to some of the after-hours places and speakeasies. When the downtown nightclubs had closed, most of these Harlem places crawled with white people. These whites were just mad for Negro atmosphere, especially some of the places which had what you might call Negro soul. Sometimes Negroes would talk about how a lot of whites seemed unable to have enough of being close around us and among us in groups. Both white men and women, it seemed, would get almost mesmerized by Negroes. I remember one really peculiar case of this, a white girl who never missed a single night in the Savoy Ballroom. She fascinated my friend Sammy. He'd watched her several times. Dancing only with Negroes, she seemed to go nearly into a trance. If a white man asked her to dance, she would refuse. Then when the place was ready to close early in the morning, she would let a Negro take her as far as the subway entrance. And that was it. She never would tell anyone her name, let alone reveal where she lived. Now, I'll tell you another peculiar case that worked out differently, and which taught me something I've since learned in 1,000 other ways. This was my best early lesson in how most white men's hearts and guts will turn over inside of them, whatever they may have you otherwise believe, whenever they see a Negro man on close terms with a white woman. A few of the white men around Harlem, younger ones whom we called hippies, acted more Negro than Negroes. This particular one talked more hip talk than we did. He would have fought anyone who suggested he felt any race difference. Musicians around the barrack could hardly move without falling over him. Every time I saw him, it was, "Daddy, come on, let's get our heads tight." Sammy couldn't stand him. He was underfoot wherever he went. He even wore a wild zoot suit, used a heavy grease in his hair to make it look like a conch, and he wore the knob-toed shoes, the long swinging chain, everything. And he not only wouldn't be seen with any woman but a black one, but in fact he lived with two of them in the same little apartment. I never was sure how they worked that one out, but I had my idea. About 3 or 4 o'clock one morning, we ran into this white boy in Creole Bill's speakeasy. He was high, in that marijuana glow where the world relaxes. I introduced Sophia. I went away to say hello to someone else. When I returned, Sophia looked peculiar, but she wouldn't tell me until we left. He had asked her, "Why is a white girl like you throwing yourself away with a spade?" Creole Bill, naturally you know he was from New Orleans, became another good friend of mine. After Smalls closed, I'd bring fast-spending white people who still wanted some drinking action to Creole Bill's speakeasy. That was my earliest experience at steering. The speakeasy was only Creole Bill's apartment. I think a partition had been knocked out to make the living room larger, but the atmosphere plus the food made the place one of Harlem's soul spots. A record player maintained the right soft music. There was any kind of drink, and Bill sold plates of his spicy, delicious Creole dishes, gumbo, jambalaya. Bill's girlfriend, a beautiful black girl, served the customers. Bill called her brown sugar, and finally everyone else did. If a good number of customers were to be served at one time, Creole Bill would bring out some pots, brown sugar would bring the plates, and Bill would serve everyone big platefuls, and he'd heap a plate for himself and eat with us. It was a treat to watch him eat. He loved his food so. It was good. Bill could cook rice like the Chinese. I mean rice that stood every grain on its own. But I never knew the Chinese to do what Bill could with seafood and beans. Bill made money enough in that apartment speakeasy to open up a Creole restaurant famous in Harlem. He was a great baseball fan. All over the walls were framed, autographed photographs of major league stars, and also some political and show business celebrities who would come there to eat, bringing friends. I wonder what's become of Creole Bill. His place is sold, and I haven't heard anything of him. I must remember to ask some of the 7th Avenue old-timers who would know. Once, when I called Sophia in Boston, she said she couldn't get away until the following weekend. She had just married some well-to-do Boston white fellow. He was in the service. He'd been home on leave, and he'd just gone back. She didn't mean it to change a thing between us. I told her it made no difference. I had, of course, introduced Sophia to my friend Sammy, and we'd gone out together some nights. And Sammy and I had thoroughly discussed the black man and white woman psychology. I had Sammy to thank that I was entirely prepared for Sophia's marriage. Sammy said that white women were very practical. He'd heard so many of them express how they felt. They knew that the black man had all the strikes against him, that the white man kept the black man down, under his heel, unable to get anywhere, really. The white woman wanted to be comfortable. She wanted to be looked upon with favor by her own kind, but also she wanted to have her pleasure. So some of them just married a white man for convenience and security and kept right on going with the Negro. It wasn't that they were necessarily in love with a Negro, but they were in love with lust, particularly taboo lust. A white man was not too unusual if he had a $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000 a year job. A Negro man who made even $5,000 in the white man's world was unusual. The white woman with a Negro man would be with him for one or two reasons: either extremely insane love, or to satisfy her lust. When I'd been around Harlem long enough to show signs of permanence, inevitably I got a nickname that would identify me beyond any confusion with two other red-conked and well-known Reds who were around. I'd met them both. In fact, later on I'd worked with them both. One, St. Louis Red, was a professional armed robber. When I was sent to prison, he was serving time for trying to stick up a dining car steward on a train between New York and Philadelphia. He was finally freed. Now I hear he's in prison for a New York City jewel robbery. The other was Chicago Red. We became good buddies in a speakeasy where later on I was a waiter. Chicago Red was the funniest dishwasher on this earth. Now he's making his living being funny as a nationally known stage and nightclub comedian. I don't see any reason why old Chicago Red would mind me telling that he is Red Fox. Anyway, before long, my nickname happened. Just when, I don't know. But people, knowing I was from Michigan, would ask me what city. Since most New Yorkers had never heard of Lansing, I would name Detroit. Gradually, I began to be called Detroit Red. And it stuck. One afternoon in early 1943, before the regular 6 o'clock crowd had gathered, a black soldier sat drinking by himself at one of my tables. He must have been there an hour or more. He looked dumb and pitiful and just up from the deep south. The fourth or fifth drink I served the soldier, wiping the table, I bent over close and asked him if he wanted a woman. I knew better. It wasn't only Small's Paradise law. It was the law of every tavern that wanted to stay in business. Never get involved with anything that could be interpreted as impairing the morals of servicemen or any kind of hustling off them. This had caused trouble for dozens of places. Some had been put off limits by the military. Some had lost their state or city licenses. I played right into the hands of a military spy. He sure would like a woman. He acted so grateful. He even put on an extreme southern accent. And I gave him the phone number of one of my best friends among the prostitutes where I lived. But something felt wrong. I gave the fellow a half hour to get there, and then I telephoned. I expected the answer I got, that no soldier had been there. I didn't even bother to go back out to the bar. I just went straight to Charlie Small's office. "I just did something, Charlie," I said. "I don't know why I did it." And I told him. Charlie looked at me. "I wish you hadn't done that, Red." We both knew what he meant. When the West Indian plainclothes detective Joe Baker came in, I was waiting. I didn't even ask him any questions. When we got to the 135th Street precinct, it was busy with police in uniform and MPs with soldiers in tow. I was recognized by some other detectives who, like Joe Baker, sometimes dropped in at Small's. Two things were in my favor. I'd never given the police any trouble, and when that black spy soldier had tried to tip me, I'd waved it away, telling him I was just doing him a favor. They must have agreed that Joe Baker should just scare me. I didn't know enough to be aware that I wasn't taken to the desk and booked. Joe Baker took me back inside of the precinct building into a small room. In the next room, we could hear somebody getting whipped. Whop! Whop! He'd cry out, "Please, please, don't beat my face. That's how I make my living." I knew from that it was some pimp. Whop! Whop! Please, please! Not much later, I heard that Joe Baker had gotten trapped over in New Jersey shaking down a Negro pimp and his white prostitute. He was discharged from the New York City police force, the state of New Jersey convicted him, and he went off to do some time. More bitter than getting fired, I was barred from Small's. I could understand. Even if I wasn't actually what was called hot, I was now going to be under surveillance, and the Small brothers had to protect their business. Sammy proved to be my friend in need. He put word on the wire for me to come over to his place. I'd never been there. His place seemed to me a small palace. His women really kept him in style. While we talked about what kind of a hustle I should get into, Sammy gave me some of the best marijuana I'd ever used. Various numbers controllers, Small's regulars, had offered me jobs as a runner. But that meant I would earn very little until I could build up a clientele. Pimping, as Sammy did, was out. I felt I had no abilities in that direction, and that I'd certainly starve to death trying to recruit prostitutes. Peddling reefers, Sammy and I pretty soon agreed, was the best thing. It was a relatively uninvolved lone wolf type of operation, and one in which I could make money immediately. For anyone with even a little brains, no experience was needed, especially if one had any knack at all with people. Both Sammy and I knew some merchant seamen and others who could supply me with loose marijuana, and musicians, among whom I had so many good contacts, were the heaviest consistent market for reefers. And then musicians also used the heavier narcotics if I later wanted to graduate to them. That would be more risky, but also more money. Handling heroin and cocaine could earn one hundreds of dollars a day, but it required a lot of experience with the narcotic squad for one to be able to last long enough to make anything. I'd been around long enough either to know or to spot instinctively most regular detectives and cops, though not the narcotics people, and among the Small's veteran hustler regulars, I had a variety of potentially helpful contacts. This was important because just as Sammy could get me supplied with marijuana, a large facet of any hustler's success was knowing where he could get help when he needed it. The help could involve police and detectives, as well as higher-ups. But I hadn't yet reached that stage. So Sammy staked me. About $20, I think it was. Later that same night, I knocked at his door and gave him back his money and asked him if I could lend him some. I'd gone straight from Sammy's to a supplier he had mentioned. I got just a small amount of marijuana, and I got some of the paper to roll up my own sticks. As they were only about the size of stick matches, I was able to make enough of them so that, after selling them to musicians I knew at the Braddock Hotel, I could pay back Sammy and have enough profit to be in business. And those musicians, when they saw their buddy and their fan in business, my man, Crazy Red. In every band, at least half of the musicians smoked reefers. I'm not going to list names. I'd have to include some of those most prominent then in popular music. Even a number of them around today. In one case, every man in one of the bands, which is still famous, was on marijuana. Or again, any number of musicians could tell you who I mean when I say that one of the most famous singers smoked his reefers through a chicken thigh bone. He had smoked so many through the bone that he could just light a match before the empty bone, draw the heat through, and get what he called a contact high. I kept turning over my profit, increasing my supplies, and I sold reefers like a wild man. I scarcely slept. I was wherever musicians congregated. A roll of money was in my pocket. Every day I cleared at least $50 or $60. In those days, or for that matter these days, this was a fortune to a 17-year-old Negro. I felt, for the first time in my life, that great feeling of free. Suddenly now I was the peer of the other young hustlers I had admired. It was at this time that I discovered the movies. Sometimes I made as many as 5 in one day, both downtown and in Harlem. I loved the tough guys, the action, Humphrey Bogart and Casablanca. And I loved all of that dancing and carrying on in such films as Stormy Weather and Cabin in the Sky. After leaving the movies, I'd make my connections for supplies, then roll my sticks. And about dark, I'd start my rounds. I'd give a couple of extra sticks when someone bought 10, which was $5 worth. And I didn't sell and run because my customers were my friends. Often I'd smoke along with them. None of them stayed any more high than I did. Free now to do what I pleased. Upon an impulse, I went to Boston. Of course, I saw Ella. I gave her some money. It was just a token of appreciation. I told her for helping me when I'd come from Lansing. She wasn't the same old Ella. She still hadn't forgiven me for Laura. She never mentioned her, nor did I. But even so, Ella acted better than she had when I'd left for New York. We reviewed the family changes. Wilford had proved so good at his trade that I asked him to stay on at Wilberforce as an instructor. And Ella had gotten a card from Reginald, who had managed to get into the Merchant Marine. From Shorty's apartment, I called Sophia. She met me at the apartment just about as Shorty went off to work. I would have liked to take her out to some of the Roxbury clubs, but Shorty had told us that, as in New York, the Boston cops used the war as an excuse to harass interracial couples, stopping them and grilling the Negro about his draft status. Of course, Sophia's now being married made us more cautious, too. When Sophia caught a cab home, I went to hear Shorty's band. Yes, he had a band now. He had succeeded in getting a 4F classification, and I was pleased for him and happy to go. His band was, well, fair. But Shorty was making out well in Boston, playing in small clubs. Back in the apartment, we talked until the next day. "Homeboy, you're something else," Shorty kept saying. I told him some of the wild things I'd done in Harlem and about the friends I had. I told him the story of Sammy the Pimp. In Sammy's native Paducah, Kentucky, he'd gotten a girl pregnant. Her parents made it so hot that Sammy had come to Harlem, where he got a job as a restaurant waiter. When a woman came in to eat alone, and he found she really was alone, not married or living with somebody, it generally was not hard for smooth Sammy to get invited to her apartment. He'd insist on going out to a nearby restaurant to bring back some dinner, and while he was out, he would have her key duplicated. Then, when he knew she was away, Sammy would go in and clean out all her valuables. Sammy was then able to offer some little stake to help her back on her feet. This could be the beginning of an emotional and financial dependency, which Sammy knew how to develop until she was his virtual slave. Around Harlem, the narcotic squad detectives didn't take long to find out I was selling reefers, and occasionally one of them would follow me. Many a peddler was in jail because he'd been caught with the evidence on his person. I figured a way to avoid that. The law specified that if the evidence wasn't actually in your possession, you couldn't be arrested. Hollowed-out shoe heels, fake hat linings, these things were old stuff to the detectives. I carried about 50 sticks in a small package inside my coat, under my armpit, keeping my arm flat against my side. Moving about, I kept my eyes open. If anybody looked suspicious, I'd quickly cross the street, or go through a door, or turn a corner, loosening my arm enough to let the package drop. At night, when I usually did my selling, Any suspicious person wouldn't be likely to see the trick. If I decided I'd been mistaken, I'd go back and get my sticks. However, I lost many a stick this way. Sometimes I knew I'd frustrated a detective, and I kept out of the courts. One morning, though, I came in and found signs that my room had been entered. I knew it had been detectives. I'd heard too many times how if they couldn't find any evidence, they would plant some, where you would never find it. Then they'd come back in and find it. I didn't even have to think twice what to do. I packed my few belongings and never looked back. When I went to sleep again, it was in another room. It was then I began carrying a little 25 automatic. I got it for some reefers from an addict who I knew had stolen it somewhere. I carried it pressed under my belt right down the center of my back. Someone had told me that the cops never hit there in any routine patting down. And unless I knew who I was with, I never allowed myself to get caught in any crush of people. The narcotics cops had been known to rush up and get their hands on you and plant evidence while searching. And I felt that as long as I kept on the go and in the open, I had a good chance. I don't know now what my real thoughts were about carrying the pistol, but I imagine I felt that I wasn't going to get put away if somebody tried framing me in any situation that I could help. I sold less than before because having to be so careful consumed so much time. Every now and then, on a hunch, I'd move to another room. I told nobody but Sammy where I slept. Finally, it was on the wire that the Harlem Narcotics Squad had me on its special list. Now, every other day or so, usually in some public place, they would flash the badge to search me. But I'd tell them at once, loud enough for others standing about to hear me, that I had nothing on me and I didn't want to get anything planted on me. Then they wouldn't, because Harlem already thought little enough of the law, and they did have to be careful that some crowd of Negroes would not intervene roughly. Negroes were starting to get very tense in Harlem. One could almost smell trouble ready to break out, as it did very soon. But it was really tough on me then. I was having to hide my sticks in various places near where I was selling. I put 5 sticks in an empty cigarette pack and dropped the empty-looking pack by a lamppost or behind a garbage can or a box. And I'd first tell customers to pay me and then where to pick up. But my regular customers didn't go for that. You couldn't expect a well-known musician to go grubbing behind a garbage can. So I began to pick up some of the street trade. The people you could see looked high. I collected a number of empty Red Cross bandage boxes and used them for drops. That worked pretty good. But the Middle Harlem Narcotics Force found so many ways to harass me that I had to change my area. I moved down to Lower Harlem, around 110th Street. There were many more reefer smokers around there. These were a cheaper type. This was the worst of the ghetto. The poorest people, the ones who in every ghetto keep themselves narcotized to keep from having to face their miserable existence. I didn't last long down there either. I lost too much of my product. After I sold to some of those reefer smokers who had the instincts of animals, they followed me and learned my pattern. They would dart out of a doorway, I'd drop my stuff, and they would be on it like a chicken on corn. When you become an animal, a vulture in the ghetto, as I had become, you enter a world of animals and vultures. It becomes truly the survival of only the fittest. Soon I found myself borrowing little stakes from Sammy, from some of the musicians, enough to buy supplies, enough to keep high myself, enough sometimes to just eat. Then Sammy gave me an idea. "Red, you still got your old railroad identification?" I did have it. They hadn't taken it back. "Well, why don't you use it to make a few runs until the heat cools?" He was right. I found that if you walked up and showed a railroad line's employee identification card, the conductor, even a real cracker if you approached him right, not begging, would just wave you aboard. And when he came around, he would punch you one of those little coach seat slips to ride wherever the train went. The idea came to me that this way, I could travel all over the East Coast selling reefers among my friends who were on tour with their bands. I have the New Haven identification. I worked a couple of weeks for other railroads to get their identification. And then I was set. In New York, I rolled and packed a great quantity of sticks and sealed them into jars. The identification card worked perfectly. If you persuaded the conductor you were a fellow employee who had to go home on some family business, he just did the favor for you without a second thought. Most whites don't give a Negro credit for having sense enough to fool them, or nerve enough. I'd turn up in towns where my friends were playing. "Red!" I was an old friend from home. In the sticks, I was somebody from the Braddock Hotel. "My man, Daddy-O." And I had Big Apple reefers. Nobody had ever heard of a traveling reefer peddler. I followed no particular band. Each band's musicians knew the other band's one-nighter touring schedules. When I ran out of supplies, I'd return to New York and load up, then hit the road again. Auditoriums or gymnasiums all lighted up, the band's chartered bus outside, the dressed-up, excited local dancers pouring in. At the door, I'd announced that I was some bandman's brother. In most cases, they thought I was one of the musicians. Throughout the dance, I'd show the country folks some plain and fancy lindy hopping. Sometimes I'd stay overnight in a town. Sometimes I'd ride the band's bus to their next stop. Sometimes back in New York, I would stay a while. Things had cooled down. Word was around that I'd left town, and the narcotics squad was satisfied with that. In some of the small towns, people thinking I was with the band even mobbed me for autographs. Once, in Buffalo, my suit was nearly torn off. My brother Reginald was waiting for me one day when I pulled into New York. The day before, his merchant ship had put into port over New Jersey. Thinking I still worked at Small's, Reginald had gone there, and the bartenders had directed him to Sammy, who put him up. It felt good to see my brother. It was hard to believe that he was once the little kid who tagged after me. Reginald now was almost 6 feet tall, but still a few inches shorter than me. His complexion was darker than mine, but he had greenish eyes and a white streak in his hair, which was otherwise dark reddish, something like mine. I took Reginald everywhere, introducing him. Studying my brother, I liked him. He was a lot more self-possessed than I'd been at 16. I didn't have a room right at the time, but I had some money, so did Reginald, and we checked into the St. Nicholas Hotel on Sugar Hill. It has since been torn down. Reginald and I talked all night about the Lansing years, about our family. I told him things about our father and mother that he couldn't remember. Then Reginald filled me in on our brothers and sisters. Wilfred was still a trade instructor at Wilberforce University. Hilda, still in Lansing, was talking of getting married. So was Filbert. Reginald and I were the next two in line. And Yvonne, Wesley, and Robert were still in Lansing, in school. Reginald and I laughed about Filbert, who the last time I'd seen him had gotten deeply religious. He wore one of those round straw hats. Reginald's ship was in for about a week getting some kind of repairs on its engines. I was pleased to see that Reginald, though he said little about it, admired my living by my wits. Reginald dressed a little too loudly, I thought. I got a reefer customer of mine to get him a more conservative overcoat and suit. I told Reginald what I had learned, that in order to get something, you had to look as though you already had something. Before Reginald left, I urged him to leave the Merchant Marine and I would help him get started in Harlem. I must have felt that having my kid brother around me would be a good thing. Then there would be two people I could trust. Sammy was the other. Reginald was cool. At his age, I would have been willing to run behind the train to get to New York and to Harlem. But Reginald, when he left, said, "I'll think about it." Not long after Reginald left, I dragged out the wildest zoot suit in New York. This was 1943. The Boston Draft Board had written me at Ella's, and when they had no results there, I'd notified the New York Draft Board, and in care of Sammy, I received Uncle Sam's greetings. In those days, only three things in the world scared me. Jail, a job, and the Army. I had about 10 days before I was to show up at the induction center. I went right to work. The Army intelligence soldiers, those black spies in civilian clothes, hung around in Harlem with their ears open for the white man downtown. I knew exactly where to start dropping the word. I started noising around that I was frantic to join the Japanese Army. When I sensed that I had the ears of the spies, I would talk and act high and crazy. A lot of Harlem hustlers actually had reached that state, as I would later. It was inevitable when one had gone long enough on heavier and heavier narcotics and under the steadily tightening vise of the hustling life. I'd snatch out and read my greetings aloud to make certain they heard who I was, and when I'd report downtown. This was probably the only time my real name was ever heard in Harlem in those days. The day I went down there, I costumed like an actor. With my wild zoot suit, I wore the yellow knob-toe shoes, and I frizzled my hair up into a reddish bush of conk. I went in skipping and tipping, and I thrust my tattered greetings at that reception desk's white soldier. "Crazy old daddy-o, get me moving. I can't wait to get in that brown." Very likely that soldier hasn't recovered from me yet. They had their wire on me from uptown, all right, but they still put me through the line. In that big starting room were 40 or 50 other prospective inductees. The room had fallen vacuum quiet, with me running my mouth a mile a minute, talking nothing but slang. I was going to fight on all fronts. I was going to be a general man before I got done. Such talk as that. Most of them were white, of course. The tender-looking ones appeared ready to run from me. Some others had that vinegary, worst kind of nigger look. And a few were amused, seeing me as the Harlem jigaboo archetype. Also amused were some of the room's 10 or 12 Negroes. But the stony-faced rest of them looked as if they were ready to sign up to go off killing somebody. They would have liked to start with me. The line moved along. Pretty soon, stripped to my shorts, I was making my eager-to-join comments in the medical examination rooms. And everybody in the white coats that I saw had 4F in his eyes. I stayed in the line longer than I expected before they siphoned me off. One of the white coats accompanied me around a turning hallway. I knew we were on the way to a head shrinker, the Army psychiatrist. The receptionist there was a Negro nurse. I remember she was in her early 20s and not bad to look at. She was one of those Negro firsts. Negroes know what I'm talking about. Back then, the white man during the war was so pressed for personnel that he began letting some Negroes put down their buckets and mops and dust rags and use a pencil, or sit at some desk, or hold some 25-cent title. You couldn't read the Negro press for the big pictures of smug black firsts. Somebody was inside with a psychiatrist. I didn't even have to put on an act for this black girl. She was already sick of me. When finally a buzz came on her desk, she didn't send me. She went in. I knew what she was doing. She was going to make clear in advance what she thought of me. This is still one of the black man's big troubles today. So many of those so-called upper-class Negroes are so busy trying to impress on the white man that they are different from those others, that they can't see they're only helping the white man to keep his low opinion of all Negroes. And then, with her prestige in the clear, she came out and nodded to me to go in. I must say this for that psychiatrist. He tried to be objective and professional in his manner. He sat there and doodled with his blue pencil on a tablet, listening to me spiel to him for 3 or 4 minutes before he got a word in. His tack was quiet questions, to get at why I was so anxious. I didn't rush him. I circled and hedged, watching him closely, to let him think he was pulling what he wanted out of me. I kept jerking around backward as though somebody might be listening. I knew I was going to send him back to the books to figure what kind of a case I was. Suddenly I sprang up and peeped under both doors, the one I'd entered and another that probably was a closet. And then I bent and whispered fast in his ear, "Daddy-o, now you and me, we're from up north here, so don't you tell nobody. I want to get sent down south, organize them nigger soldiers, you dig? Steal us some guns and kill up crackers." That psychiatrist's blue pencil dropped and his professional manner fell off in all directions. He stared at me as if I were a snake's egg hatching, fumbling for his red pencil. I knew I had him. I was going back out past Miss First when he said, "That will be all." A 4F card came to me in the mail, and I never heard from the Army any more, and never bothered to ask why I was rejected. Chapter 7. Hustler. I can't remember all the hustles I had during the next 2 years in Harlem. After the abrupt end of my riding the trains and peddling reefers to the touring bands. Negro railroad men waited for their trains in their big locker room on the lower level of Grand Central Station. Big blackjack and poker games went on in there around the clock. Sometimes $500 would be on the table. One day in a blackjack game, an old cook who was dealing the cards tried to be slick, and I had to drop my pistol in his face. The next time I went into one of those games, intuition told me to stick my gun under my belt right down the middle of my back. Sure enough, someone had squealed. 2 big, beefy-faced Irish cops came in. They frisked me, and they missed my gun where they hadn't expected one. The cops told me never again to be caught in Grand Central Station unless I had a ticket to ride somewhere. And I knew that by the next day, every railroad's personnel office would have a blackball on me. So I never tried to get another railroad job. There I was back in Harlem streets, among all the rest of the hustlers. I couldn't sell reefers. The dope squad detectives were too familiar with me. I was a true hustler, uneducated, unskilled at anything honorable, and I considered myself nervy and cunning enough to live by my wits, exploiting any prey that presented itself. I would risk just about anything. Right now, in every big city ghetto, tens of thousands of yesterday's and today's school dropouts are keeping body and soul together by some form of hustling in the same way I did. And they inevitably move into more and more, worse and worse, illegality, and immorality. Full-time hustlers never can relax to appraise what they're doing and where they are bound. As is the case in any jungle, the hustler's every waking hour is lived with both the practical and the subconscious knowledge that if he ever relaxes, if he ever slows down, the other hungry, restless foxes, ferrets, wolves, and vultures out there with him won't hesitate to make him their prey. During the next 6 to 8 months, I pulled my first robberies and stick-ups, only small ones, always in other nearby cities, and I got away. As the pros did, I too would key myself to pull these jobs by my first use of hard dope. I began with Sammy's recommendation, sniffing cocaine. Normally now, for streetwear, I might call it, I carried a hardly noticeable little flat blue steel 25 automatic, but for working, I carried a 32, a 38, or a 45. I saw how when the eyes stared at the big black hole, the faces fell slack and the mouths sagged open. And when I spoke, the people seemed to hear as though they were far away, and they would do whatever I asked. Between jobs, staying high on narcotics kept me from getting nervous. Still, upon sudden impulses, just to play safe, I would abruptly move from one to another $15 to $20 a week room, always in my favorite 147th, 150th Street area, just flanking Sugar Hill. Once on a job with Sammy, we had a pretty close call. Someone must have seen us. We were making our getaway running when we heard the sirens. Instantly, we slowed to walking. As the police car screeched to a stop, we stepped out into the street, meeting it, hailing it to ask for directions. They must have thought we were about to give them some information. They just cursed us and raced on. Again, it didn't cross the white man's minds that a trick like that might be pulled on them by Negroes. The suits that I wore, the finest, I bought hot for about $35 to $50. I made it my rule never to go after more than I needed to live on. Any experienced hustler will tell you that getting greedy is the quickest road to prison. I kept cased in my head vulnerable places and situations, and I would perform the next job only when my bankroll in my pocket began to get too low. Some weeks I bet large amounts on the numbers. I still played with the same runner with whom I'd started in Small's Paradise. Playing my hunches, many a day I'd have up to $40 on two numbers, hoping for that fabulous 600-to-1 payoff. But I never did hit a big number, full force. There's no telling what I would have done if ever I'd landed $10,000 or $12,000 at one time. Of course, once in a while I'd hit a small combination figure. Sometimes, flush like that, I'd telephone Sevilla to come over from Boston for a couple of days. I went to the movies a lot again. And I never missed my musician friends wherever they were playing, either in Harlem, downtown at the big theaters, or on 52nd Street. Reginald and I got very close the next time his ship came back into New York. We discussed our family and what a shame it was that our book-loving oldest brother, Wilfred, had never had the chance to go to some of those big universities where he would have gone far. And we exchanged thoughts we had never shared with anyone. Reginald, in his quiet way, was a mad fan of musicians and music. When his ship sailed one morning without him, a principal reason was that I had thoroughly exposed him to the exciting musical world. We had wild times backstage with the musicians when they were playing the Roxy or the Paramount. After selling reefers with the bands as they traveled, I was known to almost every popular Negro musician around New York in 1944-1945. Reginald and I went to the Savoy Ballroom, the Apollo Theater, the Braddock Hotel Bar, the nightclubs and speakeasies, wherever Negroes play music. The great Lady Day, Billie Holiday, hugged him and called him Baby Brother. Reginald shared tens of thousands of Negroes' feelings that the living end of the big bands was Lionel Hampton's. I was very close to many of the men in Hamp's band. I introduced Reginald to them, and also to Hamp himself and Hamp's wife and business manager, Gladys Hampton. One of this world's sweetest people is Hamp. Anyone who knows him will tell you that he'd often do the most generous things for people he barely knew. As much money as Hamp has made, and still makes, he would be broke today if his money and his business weren't handled by Gladys, who is one of the brainiest women I ever met. The Apollo Theater's owner, Frank Shipman, could tell you. He generally signed bands to play for a set weekly amount, but I know that once during those days, Gladys Hampton instead arranged a deal for Hamp's band to play for a cut of the gate. Then the usual number of shows was doubled up, if I'm not mistaken, 8 shows a day instead of the usual 4. And Hamp's pulling power cleaned up. Gladys Hampton used to talk to me a lot, and she tried to give me good advice. "Calm down, Red." Gladys saw how wild I was. She saw me headed toward a bad end. One of the things I liked about Reginald was that when I left him to go away working, Reginald asked me no questions. After he came to Harlem, I went on more jobs than usual. I guess that what influenced me to get my first actual apartment was my not wanting Reginald to be knocking around Harlem without anywhere to call home. That first apartment was 3 rooms for $100 a month, I think, in the front basement of a house on 147th Street between Convent and St. Nicholas Avenues. Living in the rear basement apartment, right behind Reginald and me, was one of Harlem's most successful narcotics dealers. End of side 3.